Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this afternoon session of the 2021 Sydney Writers Festival. My name's Ashley Hay, I'm the editor of Griffith Review. I have to say it's very lovely to be in a real room with all of you real people. Thank you very much for being here. I want to apologise to the people who I look like I'm turning my back on, but I'm doing that so I can see these two people over here, and if you look at them, I'm the least important part of the equation, so should all be fine. I'd like first of all to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land we're meeting on this afternoon, the Eora people of the Gadigal Nation. I'd like to acknowledge their elders, past, present and emerging, and I'd particularly like to acknowledge to the millennia of stories that have been told across this continent. I'd also like to acknowledge the particular privilege of being able to come together again here to share this conversation with all of you today. So it's my pleasure to introduce you to two of Australia's finest authors, Malcolm Knox, the furthest person away from me, and Michael Rowbotham. And the conduits for this conversation this afternoon are their two most recent books. Malcolm's Bluebird was published late last year and will deliver for Sydney readers, I think, a pretty familiar kind of coastal landscape and a sense of a lost or under threat world. Michael's When She Was Good is set in a more northerly part of the world, but it, in a really interesting way, is also about a lost or non-existent time because it's set in March 2020, which some of you may remember where you were, but we'll come back to that. What makes these stories interesting to explore in tandem, apart from a very long friendship between these two authors, which I think we'll come back to as we go, is that both books are in very different ways large stories of salvation and redemption and of secrets and of loss. These writers also both have journalism in their background, and they also have the sort of translational or interpretational work of ghostwriting as well, which is a really fascinating space to think about in terms of establishing voice and establishing trust. So I'd like to try to talk about all of these things and whether there are sometimes slithers or intersections between them and that kind of real life input and what ends up on the page in fiction. The one thing I understand we are not going to talk about at all this afternoon is golf.
You just talked about golf. You just did exactly what you said you weren't going to do.
We are not going to talk about golf. So I'm going to begin, Malcolm, with you and Bluebird. Lots of people will know you from your journalism and your previous books, including Summerland and The Wonder Lover, and you've won all sorts of awards, including the Ned Kelly Award, the Colin Roderick Award, the Ashurst Business Prize, the Human Rights Commission Award, and several Walkleys. Can you introduce us to the world of Bluebird? It's, what's that line, 7 miles from the city and 1,000 miles from care. The city, of course, that is near Bluebird is called Ocean City, and the slightly bigger suburb down the way is called Capri. Where is Bluebird, and who are we going to meet when we get there?
Well, where was Bluebird originally? In my head, I lived not too far from Freshwater Beach, and I have surfed there for a number of years, and there's a house, and I don't know if how many people are familiar with Freshwater, at the southern end of the beach, halfway up the cliff face, there's a house that is, you know, literally suspended on the cliff face. It's joined to the beach by a zigzagging wooden staircase, and it has to pass up through another stairway, passing up through not one but two other houses before it gets to the street. So aside from the being fascinated by the logistical contemplation of moving furniture in and out, I just wondered how it had got there. And I still don't actually know how it got there or when it got there, but sitting in the water is a lovely place for losing your mind in speculation about stories. And just like if you're a little kid making stories up, I was sitting there looking at that house and inventing a history for it. And as happens, I would put inside the house random people who were sitting in the water near me, and I'd wonder, well, who's that guy? I wonder what his story is, or who's she? And yeah, I'll put them in the house too, and see what happens. And so that's really the heart and soul of the story. Everything kind of flowered out from there. But little could I anticipate that, and I suppose you always want something not to be specific. You want to drill into the specific to find the universal beyond that, and not only to find other coastal places in that one place, but other communities that have common elements. But I did meet a fellow who looked like a character from my book from Bluebird. I met him at a party, and he came up to me and he said, "Yeah, I'm halfway through." And I said, "Oh, you know, nice to meet you. Are you enjoying it?" And he said, "Good that you write about Dicko and Tomo and Shazza, and what do they think of it?" And I said, "I've got no idea who you're talking about." And he said, he just continued. He said, "Oh yeah, and you know, poor old Simo, he died a few years ago. He'd have loved it." And I said, "Yeah, you know, I'm feeling sorry for Simo now too." But that was probably the nicest moment I've had, even though I couldn't get through to this guy that I was not writing about his friends. He wandered off muttering to himself.
He was wrong, and because you were writing about Palm Beach, and I know the house, I know the house, and all those guys, you know. Yeah, no, it's not fresh water at all.
I'm sure it's on the south coast where I grew up. I can put a house on the south coast somewhere down there. I like that, though, drilling into the specific to find the universal. And I do want to talk about the characters a little bit. So our main guy is Gordon Grimes, and he's sharing a bedroom with his son and his goddaughter. His ex-wife is in another room in this house that's falling off the side of the cliff. He's still there are these people that he went to school with, Fiery Sam and the dog. The arch villain in the book is his mother-in-law, who owns most of the house that they're all in but isn't in it. And then there's the regulars on the beach, Redcap and Snake, and the, I can't remember how many times, state champion, who's always referred to that way. Now, I know all these people.
Yeah, so do I.
They're on the beach that I grew up on as well. And I wonder, well, obviously they're archetypes in a sense, but there's a beautiful scene in the book where Tonsure Man is picking a book off a kind of lending library that Gordon has set up, and it's an Australian novel, and he's talking to Gordon about whether he should read it or not, and Gordon is, you know, kind of prevaricating a bit. And I'm wondering, all these characters, are they usually the characters that would turn up in one of those Australian novels, or is this a kind of a different incursion for them off the beach and into the pages?
That's a really interesting question, and I'm probably not educated enough to answer it. By way of the Australian novel more generally, but I think the feeling of a lost tribe and a tribe under threat, and the particularity in this story is that Gordon has come into possession of the house. It's sort of everything he wants, and yet he has no means of looking after what he's been given. And so the tension in the book is he going to be able to hang on to it or not? And you know, how will that affect the meaning of this place to him? And that, you know, I've probably just described the one of the major themes of Australian fiction, which is that kind of present past thing. And also, I wouldn't make any great claims to the you know, to the tribalism or the ethnicity of the people in the book, but I see them as a last tribe who are being, at least their sense of the world is that they're being invaded by others.
Yeah.
Now, that's also kind of comic that you can be white and privileged and all of those things and yet
feel dispossessed.
But that is also the story of the Australia we live in for many people. Mm. So thank you for saying it had so much of Australian literature in it. I feel flattered to hear that.
I mean, it's funny, it's interesting. Because when I read it, it was where I grew up, in the sense that I grew up in Coffs Harbour. It's one of the places I spent my high school years. And when we moved there, there were 10,000 people, and by the time I left, there were 100,000 people. Mm. And that onward press of progress, of that just rush that just could not be stopped, and the people that felt so disaffected or that they were being left behind. I mean, all of those things I relived when I read Bluebird.
And I think it's important to say too, because in introducing Michael Rowbotham to you all, you know, I will also tell you that Michael also started working life as a journalist and covered big stories like Fred and Rosemary West and Stalin's Hitler files and things. And now, as you would all know, writes crime novels that have sold millions of copies around the world, including When She Was Good, which is the book we're going to talk about today. But I wanted to start the conversation with you, not with your book, but with Malcolm's, because you're identified as an honorary bluebirder in the acknowledgements. And I'm interested that that's from your childhood and not necessarily just, you know, space that you might share now, not your sort of adult surfing life.
Well, I
think,
Malcolm put that in. I don't know why. I mean, in a sense, I mean, I'm very flattered by that, because I did feel like it was sort of, I grew up in a bluebird type place and watched it sort of change, you know, beyond all reason. But I also, maybe because, I mean, I read a very early version of it, you know.
And that was why you were. Yeah. And Ash, the story, Mike was, I think, the second person to read an early draft. And I was so grateful to him for putting in the time to do it. When we were meeting after his read, I got quite an expensive bottle of champagne to give him as a gift. And when we met, it was the first thing I did. I pulled it out and I said, you know, Michael, just thank you. And he said, hold the champagne. you might not like what I'm about to tell you.
I'll get you a whiskey.
Yeah. He got the champagne in the end. But you know, a great. It is a privilege, I think, of you know, having a friend like this, where you know they're such a great technician, and in many ways, Michael and I kind of complement each other as writers. I see everything he does well as the things I do badly, and I went to Michael very specifically for help and technical expertise. And while he was quite tough, I think I benefited from it.
Yeah.
The Michael Rowbotham Mentoring and Editorial Assessment Service.
It's going to be a mutual love fest here in a minute, because I actually, it's a really good way of putting it, because there are things that Malcolm does that just completely stun me. He's descriptively and how he captures, you know, people and places and whatnot. Yeah.
But I think this is to slightly step away from the love fest. But I think it's an interesting part of the craft in a way. It's always intrigued me. Often, if you're working editorially with someone who does know you really well, it's a different process, because you know what's inside each other's heads, in a sense. So you can often see what the person's trying to do on the page, and there's a different step you can take.
Yeah, but what stunned me is like that Malcolm had, like, I adore Malcolm and I rate him so highly, but I would never show him an early copy of my book, because because I do rate him so highly that if I'd been as honest, if he was as honest with me as I was with him, I'd probably never speak to him again. Let alone give him a bottle of champagne. I'm terrible when it comes to it. It's like, my wife is my first designated reader, knows that when she reads the book, she just says it's terrific.
And so, then you give it the champagne.
What don't you like about it? I like everything about it. Because she knows full well, she says, no, I'm not going to be the one that tells you. I'm going to let some editor get their head bitten off.
Well, I know we're friends, but we won't wife swap. My story of feedback from my wife, who is very often the first reader of my novels, is, you know, she's always very kind and nice, but she'll slip in, oh, you know, maybe you could do this a little bit differently. And I, of course, am, you know, really thin-skinned at that point.
Yep, rubbish.
That's me. Absolute rubbish. Yeah. Oh, you might want to do that. No, stupid idea. And then four drafts later, when I've spoken to, you know, Michael or somebody else, I'll go to her and I'll say, look, I think I've decided to do this. It's a good idea, isn't it? And she said, that's what I suggested. And you told me it was rubbish. But, you know, you need to get under your skin and then to somehow become your own.
Yeah.
And then ask forgiveness for what you
exactly
said.
What that's like. It's like even with editorial notes, I'll write, when I get my editorial notes in, I will write the most poisonous email in response, but not send it. And 24 hours later, I'll tone it down, but still not send it. And then after 48 hours, I'll write an email saying, okay, you're wrong, but you're not completely wrong. And but I think favorite, I've got to tell this story, talking about wives, because Vivian's the first person to read my book. And I want to physically sit there and watch her read.
That's awful.
I know, it is awful.
You can't
but
do
I haven't,
that to
I have, But I have not shown another soul, so I want to watch. And so I get sent out of the room. So I watch through a crack in the door.
I would send you out of
and,
the state.
And,
that will,
and, then, and, wait, and then when I see her laugh or smile at something, she'll hear this voice go, what was that bit? and then I'll get, you know, sent out to the cabana of cruelty, the office saying, no, you have to stay out there. And then at some point in the story, someone that I have made her fall in love with will die horribly. And I'll hear it, she'll come storming out of the house and she'll thump me on the chest and go, bring them back.
I'm very tempted at this point, since I am in possession of the knowledge that both your wives are in the room, I'm really tempted to throw the two of you off stage and just continue this
what
conversation about your writing
session.
Life
yeah,
with
yeah.
them. I won't. Michael, I want to talk now a little bit about When She Was Good, which your readers will know that this is bringing us back into the story of Evie Cormack and Cyrus Haven that began with Good Girl, Bad Girl. Now, this isn't just the second book with Cyrus Haven as the sort of, you know, curious person who's important at the centre of a crime novel, but it's the continuation of Evie Cormack's story as well. Can you tell us a little bit first about where we are with When She Was Good? And then I'd also like to talk about Evie too and what led to her story in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, the story began, I mean, they can be read as standalones if you haven't read them, but the story began with Good Girl, Bad Girl when Cyrus Haven, a psychologist, is sent into a children's home to interview, a secure children's home, to interview a young girl called Evie Cormack, although that's not actually a real name. 6 years earlier, she'd been found hiding in a secret room in a house where a man had been tortured to death. And she refused to reveal her name or her age. And I guess, you know, she's put in, no one will adopt her. Every attempt made to adopt her fails, and she's kept in this children's home. And Cyrus, she now claims to be 18. And so Cyrus is sent into the children's home to decide if she's ready to be released. Nobody knows her. The name Evie Cormack was given to her by the courts. Nobody knows her real age. And Cyrus discovers that Evie has a unique capacity to tell when someone is lying. And he realises what a curse it is. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that first book, you know, there is everything you believed that you knew about Evie gets turned on its head. But it's not until the second book that you discover who put her in that room and why she was in that room.
Mm.
You know? I mean, the first book ends on this point where a mystery is solved. But as to why, who Evie is, that is unsolved at the end of the first book. But the second book, Cyrus realises the only way he believes that Evie Cormack will ever, because she's a very traumatised, damaged young woman. I mean, it's clear she was sexually abused. It's clear she was tortured or whatever. I mean, but she will not talk about it. And he thinks the only way she will ever be free of this burden is if he discovers who put her in that room. But what he doesn't realise is the people that put her in that room are still looking for her. And in his search, he's actually putting her in enormous danger.
Mm. It must be an interesting space to be in as a crime writer. So to have a character like Cyrus go through books is, you know, they're a series and your Joe Ockham series is, you know, 9 books long. But to have Evie carry over as well, to be not finished yet with what you can explore or the story you can tell of another character.
I mean, I think in particular Evie, I mean, that idea, and look, people might have heard me say this before, but lying, I mean, all of us lie between 20 and 200 times a day. And, you know, and you might think, well, I haven't lied today, you know, but, you know, gee, you
look
good.
You've got 20 to go.
Yeah. gee, you look good. I love your new hair. You know, I'm 5 minutes away. You know, I only had the one beer. I bought it on sale. I read the terms and conditions. I mean, we lie all the time to people we love. It's the reason our relationships stay together. It's the reason families stay together. If we were all brutally honest, you can imagine what life would be like. But on that note, imagine someone like Evie who has the ability to tell when someone's lying. The impact or the power of three little words like I love you or I miss you has when you know that they're not genuine. So he realized she will go through life perhaps never having a proper relationship or a friendship because she is so damaged and he has to find some way of protecting her. And I think the beauty of the two characters working together was that Cyrus himself has got this incredibly tragic backstory. He's the sole survivor of when his family were killed, were murdered, and he became a psychologist in a sense to understand that. But Evie Cormack has got every reason to never trust another man, given what's been done to her, to never. And I think that the reason she bonds with Cyrus is that she sees in Cyrus someone who is perhaps more damaged than she is, and that perhaps together they can save each other.
I want to turn to journalism for a moment and the way it feeds your writing. I don't mean sort of in a, you know, I do this yesterday and I write this novel today, but more whether it's in terms of the kind of ongoing practice of research and discipline or maybe the inspiration for the stories in the first place. So, Michael, I was really interested to read about the very well-known story of Fred and Rosemary West and the psychologist who helped the police with their investigation and who kind of understood what had happened in that space before the police knew or before they'd, you know, got these two people to talk about it. Can you talk about the process of that fascination, the way that fed out of the journalistic work you were doing and into the creation of Joe O'Loughlin, for example?
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that my interest, my fascination with psychology, criminal psychology, came from, I mean, among the ghostwritten, you know, you mentioned the ghostwritten books I did, I wrote two books with a man called Paul Britton, who was the pioneer of offender profiling in the UK. And for argument's sake, psychologist, he was called in when the police had discovered three bodies in the back garden, buried in the back garden of a house at 74 Cromwell Street in Gloucester. House belonged to Fred and Rosemary West. And the police don't call psychologists into most murders because most murder scenes are mundane. You know, two guys get into an argument in the pub car park. You don't need someone to tell you, a psychologist to tell you what happened. But when the crime is beyond the comprehension of the police, they need someone to explain it. Like it's, and this was what was done to these bodies. It was clear they'd been tortured. Was so off the scale of normal human behaviour. They wanted a psychologist to explain to them why one person would do that to another human being. And so Paul Britton came down to Gloucester and he walked through the garden and he saw where the bodies were found and he walked through the house. And then he went back to the police station. Fred and Rosemary West were in custody, but they're denying all knowledge of how those bodies got in their garden, although one was believed to be their eldest daughter, Heather. And Paul Britton sat down with a senior detective and said, okay, you're dealing with serial sexual psychopaths. This is how they meet. This is how they combine. He went bang, bang, bang. He listed it. It listed everything. He profiled them perfectly. And the very last point he made was they bury their bodies close because they like to fantasize about what they've done. And so the detective, John Bennett, said, okay, so that's why they've used the garden. And Paul Britton said, no, they've used the garden because the house is full. They dug up the basement of the house and found seven more bodies. I wanted to know how Paul Britton knew that, how he knew that. And so when I created Joe O'Loughlin and To a Degree Cyrus, I wanted to create someone that had that understanding of human behaviour.
It's an extraordinary story and a story that, if you put in a novel, it would be complicated to make it work, which is why
a lot,
it's so, yeah.
Yeah, because people, I mean, I don't know if Malcolm agrees with journalism, that there are so many stories we can't write, you know, we can't get the evidence up, or you know, it's like a lot of people remember Joseph Fritzl, you know, the guy who imprisoned his daughter in the basement in Austria and fathered seven children by her. If I put that in a novel before it happened, people would have said, get away. Mm. Never happened. I mean, so it is oftentimes I think what we do is we tone down the truth to make it more palatable because the truth would be too bizarre.
Mm. Mm. Malcolm, I wanted to talk to you as well about the relationship between journalism and fiction. In Bluebird, Gordon himself is a defunct journalist, or perhaps the industry is defunct rather than Gordon. There is that sense. But he dreams still of heading up the coast and running a community paper up there. And I'm wondering if Gordon's experience, his sense of what's happening in that industry and his love for, you know, its possibilities still, if that embodies some of the changes that you've seen in journalism across the years, and also how the way journalism might feed your fiction has changed or developed across the years.
Yeah, it certainly does, because the industry that I came into has been decimated since then. And not only that, but the character of it, the cultural character of it, has changed quite profoundly, by which I mean it was populated by older people and experience. Was a bit like the world, a bit like, you know, the political world, which was inhabited by, you know, mostly men, but of, you know, it was nothing for a 60-plus, 65-year-old, 70-year-old to be a leader, and it was like that within the profession too. And I've always been somebody who I think I feel more comfortable with my elders than as an elder, and I still like, I guess I like people who are older than me. My son says I hate all boys aged between 15 and 20.
maybe just one.
but anyway, that's also, I think, in that, insofar as Gordon is an alter ego of mine, what he is mourning is that loss of experience and the way journalism has changed in my era is that we have much smarter people in there, much better qualified people, but also much younger people who don't have the qualities that were shoved out the door. And, you know, Gordon, a bit like me, Gordon's kind of caught between those generations, and I've been fortunate I've survived. Gordon didn't survive and is looking for something else, but he's holding on to a very pure idea of what the, you know, profession does, and at a suburban level, and this book operates at a suburban level. Gordon is, I guess, that person who, if you were going to extrapolate it out into a real life question about journalism and media, it is about the disappearance of community newspapers and if they've disappeared, what's going on that they used to trap and expose and that is not being exposed anymore. And the shenanigans that go on with local council and so on in the book can only happen in a world where nobody is looking.
I think just before I go to the next question, I want to say you need to tell your son to read Ben in Bluebird, because I think he's lovely and I think you love him as well.
I would love my son to read the train timetable. I caught him reading a book about a month ago, and it was so lovely. I took a photo of him, and then I got a bit closer to him, and his book was, what was it, 150 Great Pubs in Sydney. Something useful.
Yeah, so there are words in there. There are words. There are a lot of things falling apart in Bluebird. The house, the lodge itself. There's this gorgeous scene where Gordon rolls a marble across the floor to see if the house is tilted any further, and unsurprisingly it has. But there's also a particular raft of secrets and, misunderstandings rather than understandings that have kind of buttressed Gordon's family for a long time. The secrets of so many families in this little Bluebird place. And you've got this lovely line about villages that exist inside rapidly changing cities. You say you didn't need to move if you wanted to escape your past. You could stand right where you were and history would change around you. Can you talk a bit about that sense of malleability and of sort of slippery or shifting ground? Because it felt to me that that was something very important in terms of driving the whole story of Bluebird, the whole story of the novel itself.
Yeah. All I can say is that is my lived experience, and that is a lived experience I see around me. And it's when you talk about things that affect people emotionally, it's that very thing that they feel that they have, you know, stood or built a place and lived in a place and striven to achieve certain things, and they resent the fact that the goalposts and the meaning of what they've done has changed so much around them. My parents, and this is going a little bit away from your question, but my parents, my father died 3 years ago, and my mother moved out of their house about a year and a half ago. It was a house they had lived in for 45 years. And Dad had a book collection that was very impressive. It was books he'd read over the years, you know, a typical large-ish book collection. The book collection had no value at all. You literally couldn't give those books away. He was a stamp collector. He was a hoarder of rubbish too. But, you know, he collected... He dedicated himself to certain collections. And it's not important in any way other than the emotional way that his coin collection and his stamp collection that he had devoted decades to was now virtually worthless. He wasn't doing it because he could make money out of it, but he wasn't doing it so that he could be told at the end of his days that this is rubbish. You have dedicated your life to it. And I've just found, I suppose, the energy in many ways for the book came from that sense of sorrow for, you know, the dedication to a task. And through no evil or bad faith, it's just that people value different things. And I don't use that as a political platform at all. And I know it is a strong political platform for, you know, reactionary politics. That doesn't interest me as a novelist. What interests me is the individual and how it affects one's life.
And I think too there's something really fascinating about the way those sorts of collections have a life with the life of the person, and the life of the objects diminishes or disappears altogether.
No. When my father died, it's that idea of, you know, you go through all his writings and all his books and whatnot, and fair enough, the four children, we each take something, but you want to think, well, we should take more. There should be, because this is just going to the tip, you know. You know, he loved this, you know, this was his desk, or this was his... we don't have the room or whatever. You're right, it's a person's collection that dies with them.
Yeah, the vivacity goes in different ways. Michael, I want to talk a little bit about shifting ground in crime fiction and particularly in When She Was Good. I mean, in crime fiction, the shifting ground is part of the process of discovery or revelation, and I want to do this in a way that doesn't, you know, give any spoilers away. But in the story of Evie Cormack, and you've made reference to this already, there is a lot of shifting and revelation as the story unfolds and as you begin to understand the space that she's in and who the people are who are still looking for her and who have, you know, been involved in damaging her in the first place. Did you have a sense that the stakes were higher in Evie's story in terms of the kind of reach and impact of her story, that, you know, that sense that there's no chance of the truth setting her free? We really hold dear the idea that it will. And what she's involved in is far too complicated for that.
Yeah, no, I did, because it's really strange. This is, as I said, it can be read as a standalone, but it is part of her story covers two books. Mm. And when I don't plot my books in advance. So when I finished Good Girl, Bad Girl, I still had no idea who put Evie in that room.
Okay.
And so people would say to me, do you know, I mean, because I'd get a lot of emails saying, you know, look, we love the novel, but you didn't ever answer that question, you know. And they say, do you know? And I said, not yet, you know. So it was a voyage of discovery for me. So when Cyrus goes looking, I go looking with him.
Mm.
And I guess the only, you get a sense very early on that it's not, that this is big. That whatever conspiracy surrounds Evie, it's big. And I guess something came up several years ago where when the Jeffrey Epstein story broke, I started getting phone calls from journalists from around the world, Vanity Fair and New York Times phoning me. And they all sending me messages. They're saying, we want to talk about Jeffrey Epstein. And I go, why?
Meet him once?
You know, they said, but you were the first person to write about him. And I said, was I? And, of course, 20-something years ago, I actually wrote, when I was a feature writer in London, I wrote a bit about Ghislaine Maxwell. And he was the new man in her life, because she was far bigger figure, you know, being Robert Maxwell's daughter. And I wrote about this mystery man in her life whose name was Jeffrey Epstein, whose name then went out of my head. It was a story about Ghislaine Maxwell. But I wrote about, you know, how he was a fantasist and telling people that he'd been a concert pianist and even back in those days there was evidence emerging of what a con man and a fantasist he was and how he was obviously very rich and powerful even then. And, of course, you know, he flew under the radar until the whole Jeffrey Epstein sort of sex, you know, child sex trafficking scandal blew up. But suddenly I was the first journalist to write about him and I had no recollection. You know, and I had to go back and I still don't have notes from back in that period. I mean, certain details came back to me and I could give them contacts of people I spoke to because I flew to New York to research it. But I guess, I mean, in the back of my mind when I'm writing this thing, that story was in the back of my mind. I mean, he was a very powerful, influential man whose tentacles obviously spread to a lot of other powerful, influential men. And that was in the back of my mind.
I find that really fascinating when you talk about not plotting your books, because I've always thought about the mechanics of crime fiction as being something where, because of the way it kind of unfolds,
people often assume that, yeah, that they're, because they're, I think they're equally character-driven, it's plot-driven, but plot is very important to them. It means that somehow you've plotted out all the twists and turns. But no, I mean, when I come in from my cabana of cruelty and say to Vivian, you would not believe what just happened. you know, I figure if I didn't see it coming, neither will the reader. It does mean going back and rewriting a lot. And when you've, I mean, when I wrote a book called Say You're Sorry, I got to the penultimate chapter and I didn't know who the villain was going to be. But it meant I made 6 possible suspects, each equally credible. You know, whereas often if you know right from the very outset who it's going to be, you either try too hard to hide it or it becomes, I mean, so in a sense I thought, well, I don't know who it's going to be. I'll decide when I get there, you know.
Do you know when you're doing series, and I'm not sure if you know if you're doing a series before you're doing it, but, you know, if one of your series characters, is it possible for Joe or Cyrus to just croak and that stuffs your series, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, it's one of the reasons I fought against the TV series around Joe O'Loughlin. Looks like they're going to start filming in the UK. World Productions, who made Line of Duty and The Bodyguard, start filming that later this year. And one of the beauties of, one of the reasons I try not to sell, like, the Cyrus and Evie series people have wanted to buy, and I won't sell it because I don't want them killing off some character, you know, that I might want to carry on. You know, but I do, I love it. I got my favourite story is Val McDermid, who wrote The Wire and the Blood series of novels, and it was made into a series with Robson Green. There were more TV shows than there were novels, and so the TV writers came up with new plots, and one of them invented this female police woman, and Val was so impressed with his character, contacted the script writer and said, do you mind if I put that character in the next Rob's, you know, the next novel, the Tony Hill and Carol Jordan novel? And he was chuffed. He said, oh, no, dude, go right ahead. So Val put the character in the next book, and the scriptwriter read it. He was outraged, and he contacted her and sort of said, I based that character on my wife, and you've made her a lesbian.
I do want to come back to this question of, you know, how real people turn up in books. I just want to sit with ghostwriting for a moment, because I think it's a really fascinating space in writing, and it's not a space that gets talked about as much, because you don't tend to have ghostwriters festivals where people get together and talk about who really is the voice of, you know, whoever it may be, which cricketer or whoever. So I wanted to talk to you both about ghostwriting as an occupation, how you came to it, I guess, but also if it allowed you or if it offered you different sets of skills or disciplines, particularly in terms of something like establishing voice for characters, because if you don't get the voice right in a ghostwritten project, I imagine it's, you know, dead in the water. That's also, I guess, about trust too. Malcolm, can I ask you that one first of all?
Yeah, you come to a point in ghostwriting. So ghostwriting is largely a process of lengthy interviewing of the subject or the author of the book. You come to a fork in the road where you're facing days and days and days of tedious transcription of those, recorded interviews into text, or paying someone else to do it. And I know a lot of ghosts will just, you know, swallow that and pay a student or somebody a fee to do it. I've always done it myself, because I have a kind of great tolerance for doing really boring things for long periods of time. But I want to get something out of it as a fiction writer, as well as doing a good job in its own terms. And the one thing that I do get out of it is the training of inhabiting another person's experience through their words. And words are the only tool we've got in a book. So their words must offer you a unique way of understanding that person. And everybody speaks differently, everybody thinks differently, everybody chooses different ways of telling the stories from their life. For me, the only way to really access that deeply is those days and days and days of slow, tedious work. And that is what a ghost does, you know, literally. It haunts another human being. And I've done it for a few people now who you know, have been variously enjoyable or not enjoyable to work with. But I always know, as a fiction writer, I've got this sneaky little bowerbird in the back of me that wants to take things and use them for fiction.
Because it's inhabiting someone in a sense, isn't it? Inhabiting their cadence.
I've used a lot of stuff. I mean, Malcolm's right, it is. I mean, rough rule of thumb, I think it used to take about 60 hours. And I did 15 autobiographies for people, you know, everyone from Tony Bullimore to Lulu to Jerry Halliwell, Dennis Thatcher, Rolf, thank you. it's about 60 hours of interviews, but I always transcribe them as well, because it's all about, when you finally sit down to write, it's about capturing their voice so perfectly. Because my name never went on the cover of a single book. And so sometimes I'm acknowledged, you know, really fulsomely, like, thank you to Michael Robotham for putting my papers in order. and some of them were really fulsome, you know, properly fulsome. But, you know, it's all about writing that paragraph. We think that's their voice.
Yeah.
That's their voice. And I used to joke that, you know, once the voice is in your head, you know, I could have written War and Peace and made it sound like Jerry Halliwell.
I'd like to commission you to do that.
But yeah, I mean, because someone that's known them their entire lives should read that book and say, that's them, that's their turn of phrase. And it is that art of capturing. And I think that in my fiction, that's the reason I write in first person almost exclusively.
I spent, you know, 10 years capturing voices, and now I just capture fictional voices instead of real ones.
So much of your fiction is for, you know, is plumbing evil and trying to understand evil. Did you ever, you know, access Rolf sources of evil to help you in that fictional project
in
Ghost Rolf?
I mean, Paul Britton with all the Fred and Rosemary West stuff and all of that. I mean, that was
but he's not an evil person himself.
No. And look, with Rolf, no one knew. I mean, I wrote that book in 2000. I mean, he was convicted in 2014, so it was long before. But it was only, I mean, there were certain red flags, which I didn't realise at the time. One was that his daughter, Bindi, refused to speak to me for the book and was nowhere to be seen. And there was obviously, they were estranged. And it was only later when I worked out, when the court case happened and you looked at the dates, that's when she discovered that he had, you know, abused her school friend when she slept over. And that's the reason. And when Rolf said to me, you know, very towards the end of the book is written, you know, I said, what next? What now? And he said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life making things up to my wife and daughter. I thought he meant that I've spent 4 months of the year traveling for the last 40 years and now it's their time. But what he was really saying was, I have so wronged them that I am going to spend the rest of my life trying to help make them forgive me or give them reason to forgive me. But I didn't realise that until many years later.
I'm conscious of the time. I'm going to ask just a couple more questions and then give you some space to ask yours. But I want to just sit with this sort of slither between life and art. Michael, you were part of the Arby Awards the other night here and you were joking with Casey Bonetto about putting him into a book and knocking him off. But it made me think, I know there are crime writers who sort of auction off or offer up the naming rights of characters. I believe I appear in a John Birmingham book, which was his wedding present to me when I got married. And I'm wondering whether that's the kind of game that lots of crime writers play. It seems to me interesting because you might end up being killed or being a killer if you
enter into that space. I've auctioned, I think, 3 or 4 times names for charity. I think one person paid $15,000 to went to a Parkinson's charity.
Did they get to say if they get to kill
or be
killed?
No, it's funny. No, I always say I can't guarantee whether you're going to be a body or a pedophile or, you know, I try ultimately to make them. Although I do remember that in The Secret She Keeps, there's a wonderful lady made a big bid and it went to charity for a character in that. And she was buying it for one of the kids. And in the end, the kid said, no, Mum, you do it. Her name is Lisa Jane Sousa. And I gave it a 2 choices. I said, you can be a policewoman in it, or you can be this really racy sort of real estate agent who, you know, dresses in really sexy clothes and sort of and sleeps with married men. And I thought, you know, here she was. She was sort of, you know, married with 4 kids and whatever. And I thought, well, she's probably going to go for the racy one. She's going to do something a bit. No, I'll be the policewoman. But the beauty of that for her is that she's finished up in a TV series now. And they're going to make a second series. So she's just going to keep, it's a name that just keeps giving. That
global fame, global fame. I wanted to talk a bit about salvation and redemption. And to bring that back to the idea in Bluebird, apart from what Paul Gordon is trying to work out in his own life, there's, you know, salvation and redemption is at stake in so many spaces in that novel, and the mother-in-law, Leonie, is the big block in many ways for lots of those parts. Thinking about Michael talking about the way he discovers plots as he goes along, what was your sense of the salvation or redemption, what it might look like for Gordon as you worked on the book? Did it change where you wanted him to end up, or did you always know where Gordon was going to go?
Usually when I write a book, the only thing I know is where it's going to end. And I know the opening scene and the not the last scene, but where that main arc will end. And that's almost like trainer wheels on a bike. I just need it to stop falling over. It doesn't mean by the time I get there, that will still be the end. And I'm not going to spoil the book that everyone's going to rush out and read and reveal the ending. Definitely the means by which that redemption is achieved went through a number of changes, and I'm trying to think of, you know, what was the useful takeaway in why it changed. In part, it was just avoiding cliche.
Mm.
I had a storyline that one of my early readers said, look, you know, it's good, it works, but I've read it too often before. Mm. Think of something else.
Do better.
Great advice.
Yeah.
And also, I guess when you're spending a long time with a character, as you know, you do, you come to know them quite differently. Mm. So they're like a person. You meet and they're one person, and the longer you spend with them, the more you realise they're actually not who you thought they were.
Mm.
And as a novelist, you know, usually you get the most fruitful results when you go with that, rather than try to, you know, break them in and force them to achieve that redemption that you had planned for them.
Mm.
But I think, Gordo is such an amazing character. You want good things. So much shit falls on that man.
Mm.
You want him to have some sort of happy ending.
Which I think is part of what sort of drives you. Was like Cyrus, you know, you yeah. stay with these protagonists. The writer makes you fall in love with the protagonists, and that is part of what takes you through the book. I think it's one of those
things, like even when I know with crime fiction, they can take you into very dark places, and people can be damaged by what. They're not the same at the beginning of the book as they are at the end. They're changed. But there still has to be some sense of closure and a redemptive sort of ending to make it work for the reader to enjoy it. Because it, otherwise, you know, I don't think they, you know, it's... And I know in real life, you know, everything isn't, you know, but I go back to, I'm not saying these people, it's all happy ever after. They are damaged, but at least there's something that you can say, okay... They're going to be okay.
It's that point, yeah.
They're going to be okay.
Hmm.
You know.
I do. I've got hundreds of other questions I could ask you. I'm going to sneak one in because I found this such an interesting thing to think about when I started reading When She Was Good, and that's the note, Michael, that you have at the start talking about the fact that the book unfolds in real time, that the book is set in March 2020, and that the book was written before the advent of COVID-19. And you talk about not changing the plot line. You talk about the fact that if you had inserted a pandemic, of course, so many other things would need to change. But it made me think about the ways we can imagine COVID-19 rolling through the landscape of fiction in general and crime fiction in particular, because I loved particularly what you said about your decision to leave it as it was about offering readers a few hours where they could enjoy a world without coronavirus. What's your sense of how this might play out?
I can tell you how it's unfolding. So I've finished a new book, which is set now, this year. And I did reference the pandemic and COVID. And I actually had my publisher come back to me and said, let's not.
Okay.
Yeah, let's not. I mean, I think I've left one or two very small. They said, it dates the book. Very quickly, and B, particularly, I mean, this book is set in the UK. It has been such an appalling time there. You know, they just sort of said, let's let people read something where they don't have to be reminded of what they've been through. And similarly, I got similar notes back from my American editors saying the same thing. You know, we're quite happy if you don't. You know, if you want to take those out, we agree with the UK.
Yeah.
And so there's a couple of little references, but I had that it was a real running theme through the book initially, and they said no.
And I wonder if that's different for American and British readers, where the experience, the day-to-day experience, has been so very different to our experience, even, you know, 112 days in Melbourne, notwithstanding. No,
perhaps. And I sort of understand how quickly, you know, well, we all hope that the world gets back to being, you know, to normality within a year or two. But, you know, if you picked up the book in a year or two and read it for the first time, maybe the fact that there's all these COVID references would date it, you know, very quickly.
Absolutely. Remember all the 9/11 novels. There was a, you know, rush around 2002, 3, 4 to write a 9/11 novel or a novel that had. I don't think many of them were particularly good, and they're certainly all dated by their sense that moment was going to be the moment forever. And there's, I think the danger for a novelist is to say, well, this thing we're in now is the permanent state of things. And, you know, normally nothing is surer to date and limit the effect of a novel than that. That's the work of journalism.
Mm. Yeah. True.
Okay, I've rudely taken up more time than I should have, but I think we have time for maybe one incredibly speedy and, can I emphasise, question-y question.
Hello, it's mainly for Michael, but Malcolm as well, but mainly Michael, because I was actually, I'm from England, Manchester and Nottingham.
So I can tell.
And I was actually in Manchester and Nottingham January and February of last year. But by the by, I'm just interested in how you come about determining the location in which you set your books. You said your plot, you know, runs and runs, but your location, you've got to think about that at some point quite early on, haven't you? So I'm just curious about how you decided what way.
It's actually a funny story, because I was thinking I wanted to set a book outside of London, and I thought, but I wanted it because, you know, I've got a big international, unfortunately, big international audience, and so I wanted to choose somewhere that people would instantly recognise. So initially the plan was I was going to set it in Coventry, because everyone knew Lady Godiva in Coventry. So I went all the way to England and I went to Coventry and then discovered, as you probably well know, it's a complete shithole. And it's not Coventry's fault, but it was bombed into the oblivion in the Second World War, and it's been replaced by a very stark concrete. I mean, they're lovely people, I'm not knocking it. And so then suddenly, very quickly, when I'm in England on a research trip, said, well, I know Nottingham. And I thought the whole Robin Hood story and, you know. But then again, when I wrote the book, I had to explain to American readers, when I wrote the American edition, that Nottingham is a real place, because they thought it was like Hogwarts, you know, and that it was this fictional place where Robin Hood was. So I had to explain that it was actually a place. It was that random, I promise you. I just wanted a name that I thought everyone around the world would recognise. It's a beautiful, beautiful city, Nottingham.
And Malcolm, I'm really interested because, you know, I associate you with surf. So, you know, Bluebird made sense to me for a location. Will you keep going back, not to Bluebird specifically, but is that a particular kind of box ticked for setting the book right in the heart of where you are, or will you keep sort of playing in that space?
Look, I can make promises of different kinds, but where, you know, I'm like a dog returning to its own vomit.
But I mean, you do, so many of your novels have been set on the coast, though, on the beach. I mean, you do seem to be drawn back to
it. I just find an endless fascination with that world, and also you're trying to do something original, and I don't feel I could bring any originality to, you know, 99.9% of places, but there is one place or a set of places where I think even if I'm going back there again, I'm digging and digging and digging and finding something new.
Mm. Thank you so much to everyone. We've come to the end of our time with these two fantastic writers and their work today. Thank you all for being part of this conversation. You can keep talking with both of them, of course, in the signing queue, and more importantly, through the words that they've put on the pages for you. Writers need readers at the end of their work to complete it. And I hope you'll enjoy these books as much as I have. I wanted to thank the Sydney Writers Festival for having us. It's been lovely to be back. And now I would like to ask you to join me in thanking Malcolm Knox and Michael Robotham.
And Ashley Hay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.